Malloy here. Time for another story and another trip through the Wind Door. Now the story of a wealthy nation that lost everything, and the one organization who had no choice but to keep it all together. It's Through the Wind Door with Greg and Toby. Last time we talked about the first five chapters of Secret Rooms, which is the new beginning of the story, whereas today we're going to be talking about chapters 6 through 9, which...
The old beginning of the story.
Exactly. Which has a very different feel to it as a result of, imagine going back in time and reading the original story where we are first introduced to the characters of Annie and Butler, and then are only gradually introduced to James and Abigail talking for themselves finally. First, a lot of James, because he gets most of a chapter to himself, and then we go straight into a diplomatic negotiation disguised as an action scene, and then we finally get to hear Annie speak for herself and all of her... Like, we have already heard some of her opinions at this point as a result of arguing during the shootout, but we finally get a whole chapter dedicated to her and her feelings about whatever's going on here. Here we got into an extended reiteration of the structure of the storytelling, where it is journal entries by all the main characters. I ended up already putting a bit of that explanation into Episode 7, and some of the discussion is potential mild spoilers for Cartographer's Handbook and Arlington, so I just cut the whole thing, except for this next bit as to how Toby feels about the idea of journaling during this time of self-enforced quarantine.
I'm recording this week ? Into quarantine, and I definitely see the reasoning behind reaching out and communicating with others, or just doing something to remind yourself of who you are and how you get to where you are, that helps you maintain a sense of yourself, which, given the complete disintegration of the old world, is very important that going forward they remember who they are as people.
I now return us to the topic I originally wanted to mention, which relates to some differences as to how these opening chapters are presented in book form as opposed to audio form. There can be a marked difference between your experience of this story, whether you're listening to the audio drama or reading the written version of it. I've had a chance to, like, go over several scenes at this point, and noticing some of the differences. Before I get into those differences, a brief synopsis for new readers. When the Cartographer's Handbook was first published, it was using the vignette style of storytelling, explaining the various experiences of people going through the Wendigo Plague. Some of them recounting events during the outbreak, some the years in between as things got worse and more chaotic, and some detailing the recent past. It's a mode of storytelling that Max Brooks used in World War Z, the novel that followed on from the Zombie Survival Guide, and its influence on Alex is clear. Secret Rooms is more of a traditional narrative, but as highlighted before, it still uses that conceit of everything happening in journal entries. We've already talked about the benefits that come with that, but now it's also a part of the world building, whether mandated by some of the handbook's directives, interviewed by a cartographer, or doing it just to keep sane, this is something people in the world of New Century do. But where World War Z and the Cartographer's Handbook are written historical accounts, future New Century books often need to have a more dynamic storytelling at times. Hence, the Vox Tubes. When it's introduced here, it's an anachronistic plot device that seems like a steampunk voice recorder. Fans of video games like Bioshock will be familiar with the concept. And while they are eventually explained, for the moment it's just a means of shifting to an active voice as events play out. And while it functions fine in the story's written form, it shines best in the audio drama, where the story takes on a feel more like the Blair Witch Project or Cloverfield. For now, it's just setup. showing the audience that it exists, much like a Chekhov's gun, so that it can be used to its full potential later. And it does that by taking Catherine Holloway's abridged story of the years at Weirwood, a story that you won't hear in total until the Cartographer's Handbook, and showing how the account was originally narrated to Annie rather than written. But that narrative shift remains consistent. Sometimes, the audio drama takes on some present-tense flavor even without the Vox tube. The first time this happens is in Chapter 7, during the gunfight. In the book, there are a lot more words that go into, like, say, describing people's expressions or body language or other stuff that is going on that is not laid out in detail in the audio drama because it wouldn't work well with whatever narrative state the story is taking place in. The one in particular that comes to mind, because it's the one that first stood out to me, was when Abigail is arguing with Annie over what should be happening in terms of the negotiations between themselves and Carl and Virgil, or fuck you and Virgil, because Carl doesn't have a name at this point. In the book, we see that Annie is giving Abigail a very specific look in terms of trying to not intimidate her into submission, but just like let her disapproval be known in a way that has to be communicated only through dialogue and intonation.
Miss Gray, I would appreciate it if you would let me handle this.
It's the facial expression equivalent of kicking someone's leg from underneath the dinner table.
That's an excellent way of putting it. Sure, sure. To be clear, this isn't a complaint. It's actually a strength of the acting talent on display that I got the general gist of what was going on without needing every part described to me. And there's diegetic sound as well, what with the gunshots and all. In the book, every action is described. In the audio drama, we either picture or infer, and each works fine for the medium, even when there is no in-universe reason for it like the Vox tube. Or is there? Because the one making the journal entry for Chapter 7, start to finish, is James. And Chapter 6 already made reference to James's excellent memory. So let me propose a different theory. In the written novel, everything is as James wrote it. But in the audio drama, James is remembering it with perfect recall as he is writing the entry. So for a moment, we shift perspectives from past tense to present tense, and because it is James, it all makes sense. As we go through the rest of the chapters, I'll try to notice if there's any other moments that back up that pet theory. But in the meantime, that's not the only change between the audio and text versions of the definitive edition. When I was doing my reviewing, sometimes I'm able to sit down with the actual book in hand and look over it, and sometimes I'm not so much, you know, on my own 2 feet and listening to it on my phone these days, but I can still sync up my phone with my car, and I do have to drive places from time to time. So when I was preparing for this episode in particular, I was taking turns reading from the actual book and listening to the audio drama, and noticing for the first time that Chapter 6 begins with several of the same events that the audio drama does. But in addition, there is a description of the outside of Weirwood and a brief exchange between Butler and a lookout that sounds suspiciously like Abigail in terms of vocabulary. This is very likely a holdover from the original printing of Secret Rooms. As previously mentioned, Chapter 6 here was Chapter 1 originally, so this was the first opportunity to describe the surroundings as well as introduce one of the main characters. Why was it changed in the audio drama and not in the book? From questioning Alex about it, the answer is complex. This is not the first time that he has gone back and made slight changes to either the ebook or the audio drama. Myself, I never even considered the idea of changing a published work, until Alex told me the story about how The Hobbit got a changed reprinting to make what was essentially a children's story to fit in with some of the narrative choices for the far more adult sequel, The Lord of the Rings. And Alex has changed a lot. The ebook version I downloaded from Patreon may have been a different version than the audio drama he sent to me back in May of 2019. And it's also a lot easier to change the audio drama than the ebook. Amazon, as it turns out, has very strict rules about updating ebooks. While those rules may have a purpose, it means that when he published the definitive edition, he essentially had to put it in as a new book and remove the old from the storefront, which was a chore. And that's a massive change. Amazon definitely wouldn't do that for the change of a few paragraphs. The audio drama is easy. He sells it from Bandcamp, a storefront that will not only allow him to upload new audio files whenever he wants, but people that have purchased it can get an updated version for free. Since I didn't get my ebook from Amazon, the answer is likely I either just got an older version, or he never bothered to change it because of Amazon's frustrating rules. Either way, it doesn't make that big of a difference, and I might honestly have not even noticed it had the change not been so sizable. The freedom Bandcamp allows Alex does help in one other way, fixing audio or musical issues, as well as in a few cases, recasting roles to make for a better fit. I think it was, you said Sharon was the one that originally voiced
Catherine Holloway.
Yeah. And then was later replaced by Maya, who I don't remember off the top of my head what the overt reason was for doing this. I think to a certain level, I don't know if Alex had a relationship going on with Maya at the time that he would have been able to ask her for this kind of thing. But I think that adding more voices to help flesh out a world works better in general. But I also think you might have mentioned that having someone new voice it added levels to the character that may not have been previously been there.
Yeah, and I do really enjoy the way that Sharon brought the character to life. There was a certain sort of thematic meat to having her voice, both Abigail and Catherine, who I think you can tell as the story goes on, Abigail admires very deeply and would somewhat model herself after. So, and I think that the way Sharon plays Abigail is so distinctive that there was never really any worry that you would hear the two voices or two lines of dialogue from these two separate characters and go, well, I don't know who said what. Abigail tends to let her personality come across pretty plainly. And
yeah.
I think, though, that it may have just come to a point that, especially when these extra chapters were being recorded or being planned, first for Steamheart and now for the definitive edition of Secret Rooms, they probably reached a point that there was only so much wizardry you could pull with Catherine's voice coming through, like, the right earphone more and the Abigail's voice coming through much more on the left earpiece. And I think, you know, that works to a certain extent, but I imagine that there came a point where Alex was probably just all too happy to have someone like Maya bring this character a new, fresh breath of air.
Maya is on our list to have an interview with. I haven't forgotten you, Maya, and it's likely something we will ask her about in detail. But the fact that Catherine Holloway was going to play a larger role in the continuing narrative as early as Arlington likely affected the choice to change it, as well as the fact that Catherine and Abigail talk a lot more in the definitive edition, as Toby says. But I will listen to Sharon's voicing of Catherine as prep for our final discussion of Secret Rooms. As we're going forward, one of the other things that I wanted to talk about here is, so these first four chapters are starting to lay out the new lives of Abigail and James here. What is part two now, and what would have been part one originally, includes eight chapters. So we're doing four today, and we'll be doing four next time around. Or not, but that's getting ahead of ourselves. And as the story develops, particularly in these first four chapters, and we're getting to know our heroes and our supporting characters, small details in the story that stand out to the eye start to appear. Details which hinted a mystery or an untold story. Abigail will say things like,
I just wish he and I could have talked about it before now. Just as two adults. Even if we aren't friends anymore.
As originally written, there would not be as much context there. this is the first time that we've heard either of them speak. Now, having these other chapters ahead and having seen what their relationship was like when they were 9 years ago, when they were much younger and just getting to know each other, and seeing that they were seeming to develop a rapport together, it actually adds to that overall mystery rather than subtracting from it. We're invested in it. And more significantly, having the first five chapters as a framing device also highlights some of these moments better. It makes details stand out that otherwise might go unremarked. If things had gone originally as planned, these planted tidbits would have been more like Easter eggs there for the observant readers and listeners of Steamheart. In the conversation between Frank and James, where we're getting a sense of James for the first time as an adult and learning more about the kind of man that he wanted to become, to be the best man or no man at all, to refer back to something from the earlier chapters. We'll talk a little bit more about that in a second. That one little throwaway moment where James is suddenly asking Frank if they have any peppermint humbugs. And he's like, oh, yeah, yes, can I have one? And Frank is watching James's reaction to this simple treat and, you know, popping it in his mouth and savoring it. So this is meant to be a moment where we learn more about James's sensory capacities. Without going too far down the rabbit hole, there is a distinction between photographic memory, where a person can recall pages of alphanumeric content in great detail, eidetic memory, where people can pull up certain memories like still images, and the far broader range of mental acuity that James is able to call upon. It doesn't even really have a name on its own, as simply calling it hyperthymesia or savant syndrome doesn't really cover it. We see it in play most often in depictions of Sherlock Holmes, Hercule Poirot, or other neuroatypical characters in popular media like Zack Addy of Bones or Freddie Highmore of The Good Doctor. It includes a capacity for near-perfect recall, a hypersensitive eye for detail, and the ability to not only take in data, but to be able to understand it far better than the layman. As in James's case, there is often a cost for this, making the brain beyond expert within a specific range, and not nearly as good at handling tasks that don't fall within that range. Now that we have the added context of the earlier chapters, one of the things that I picked up on and mentioned to you in a side comment as we were preparing for this is that it's possible that maybe he was just remembering peppermint humbugs from when he was a kid, and of course they had candy in England, but I find it more likely that he's remembering that his mother used to love to drink peppermint tea.
This is why Greg is the better planner of us. He comes up with these amazing things.
No. It's just, you know, it's all about picking up details, and that's...
And it's a great detail. I love that that's there. And like you say, it's just this little passing moment in the extra chapters, and it's a, oh, that's interesting that he enjoys the peppermint humbugs. What an eccentricity. And, like, now that you've touched on that, now that you've pointed it out, it just gives it that much more meaning because, yeah, he's kind of probably thinking about his mum, and that's really sad.
What we went on to discuss here was basically synesthesia, how a piece of sensory input can trigger powerful memories, and in this case, it was James's memory of a moment so far into his past, it belongs to a different person, the person he was before the outbreak, which changed his path and the paths of many others as a part of the overall theme of New Century. The memory was possibly even jarring in a bittersweet kind of way, but he processed it and moved on. The thing I ran over the top of too fast was that in noticing that tiny detail myself and connecting it to a previous detail, I was basically doing the thing that James does as a reflex. It's not that people like you and me can't do what James does. It's that making these connections and then proceeding to dissect meaning from it is something that James can't turn off. We'll obviously get more into that as the story proceeds. But there is one final aspect about this kind of pattern matching. If we don't have the full picture, we can still come to faulty conclusions. Connecting the humbug to the tea was not necessarily a bad connection, but there were details yet to be discovered that would show me the real reason James reacted the way he did. But that's several episodes down the road. Let's return to the topic of making intriguing inferences from details by focusing on something different. Artwork. There have been a number of great pieces of artwork that have been put out by Alex's preferred artist, Antonio Torreson. The cover is obviously the first example of that, where we get to see artistic depictions of James, Abigail, and Annie, as well as a mysterious foreboding house. But since that's food for a much later conversation, let's instead reflect on the artwork inside the novel. It's still the same artist, and in most cases the same art. The important detail is that instead of fully fleshed out and colored finished works, it's included as rougher but detailed sketches. And something that I did not pick up on my first or second perusal of the story, and honestly didn't even come into focus until reading the book, was that in addition to all of the journaling that Annie and Frank have to do, being cartographers in general, is that Frank is apparently good at sketching.
James pointed out a smear of old blood on the broken window as we passed, noting the outline of a clawed handprint. Butler made note as he rode, stating that we now had no time to stop, but that on their way back through, the scouts would investigate that side. If Oakley's rifle trickery impressed me, I could see James marveling at Butler's ability to ride while drawing, annotating on an old map unfolded from his notebook.
So the juxtaposition of these sketches of our characters being interspersed among the text made me feel like this is in-universe meant to be his artwork, and that it's added verisimilitude to the story, which I found to be interesting.
I believe so, and when you suggested that, the first thing that came to mind was, did you ever play L.A. Noir?
I played a piece of L.A. Noir. I was having computer issues at the time, so unfortunately I didn't get too far through it. If there's a reference there, then I...
It's only the main character when you're sort of navigating the various menus with the different mysteries in that game. There'll often be these sort of pencil sketchings of the different characters you interact with on a case-by-case basis. And it's there to help the player to remember, oh yeah, that person, so that they're not just names on a page, in a similar way how these illustrations are a great way to give you a sort of a starting point for you to imagine these characters and go, okay, I completely see, like, it helps you along with that. But anyway, I think that in L.A. Noir, it's not only that there are those pencil sketchings, but because they're in the notepad that you physically see the main character, Cole Phelps, I think his name is.
Cole Phelps.
You can tell that he did actually draw them. And it's one of those things where you go, and this guy's very good at drawing and drawing very quickly. And you sort of, I have this image in my head of Butler just sort of seeing someone and go, hold on. And he just sort of quickly dashes it out and you go, okay, cool. The comparison just sort of illustrated to me how these drawings really are just this adding to what you were discussing earlier about there's more documentation. Everything's being documented with journal entries and the Vox tubes, and now these drawings are there to kind of just capture the essence of the people that Butler comes across, especially if they become cartographers. And in a grim sense, it might even be something for Butler to remember them by in the likely event of their death, as Annie makes very plain to Catherine in one of these chapters.
Before we move on, I'd point out that this is a guess. There's a sketch of Frank, too, and I don't have stats on an artist being able to sketch themselves, even if he's able to get a good mirror. So I may be wrong about this as well, but I'd ask Alex to just smile mysteriously in response rather than answer for sure. The book is, after all, called Secret Rooms. Yeah, it's that particular conversation was interesting. Yo que Dios en Garwood. One of the things that Annie says is that the more I like someone, the harder it's going to end up being to have to bury them along the way. And it feels like a weird thing for Annie to say, because based on our experience with both Frank and Annie as they're getting to know their charges, they seem to be pretty personable people. Annie in specific is using her empathy every chance that she gets, whether it's, you know, getting to know people and work with people and convince them to join the cartographers or join the RSA or whatever it is. Mm. So the idea that she might ever try to distance herself from anyone in order for it to be easy for her to eventually have to bury them, that doesn't feel like something that she would ever do. It doesn't feel It doesn't feel like something that Frank would do either, especially the way he goes out of his way to do something as simple as making sure that James remembers to eat.
Yeah, and we'll come back to that, because that's a wonderful little moment there. I think that it is certainly a case that Annie is very good at reading people and empathizing with other people, because the very first subject that we hear her talk about, writing about, it is talking about because it's a Vox tube, but is she says there's a point in the conversations she has with people when she's trying to convince them that she knows if she's got them. And she says it's not only that she can recognize that little sort of tell in that person, it's the fact that she's not altogether sure she likes having that feeling. She doesn't like seeing them in this objectified manner where they're prey to be hunted. A mark. And I think that that means that I don't think that Annie would necessarily want to distance herself from the people in her charge. I think that for as much as she may reason out that the more I like them, the harder it's going to be if and when I need to bury them. And I think it's probably the case that Annie can't help but empathize with these people. She knows that in all likelihood, I am going to form some sort of connection with these people, and it's going to hurt like hell when I have to bury them. And I think that it's just a sort of, it's a moment of vulnerability, because it shows not only is she being completely blunt with Catherine and not giving her the sell, she's also showing that she isn't this resolute, hardened military machine who knows the best way. She realizes that she will hurt when this happens, and she has hurt when she's had to do this in the past. So it is a moment of trust with Catherine that she shows this vulnerability. And I think that we're to infer that Annie is probably very good at showing that when she needs to, when she judges is the right time.
Well, here's a follow-up question that I'm curious to hear your thoughts on, because it's not something that it's something that only occurred to me just now as I was listening to you talk. On some level, is this a self-imposed punishment? It may not be deliberate or anything like that, but if she has to go out and be the PR face of the cartographers and of the RSA, is the idea that she ends up getting close to those that she wins over or chooses to take under her wing, or however she chooses to follow up on this kind of thing? Frame it. Yeah, exactly. Does she do these things not just because she likes people and cares about them and wants to see them do well, but because of the guilt that she feels for having lured them closer to their destruction, so to speak?
I think so. You can already tell that Annie is someone who is very committed to the wider mission of the reunified states to try to recruit as many people, because, as she tells Catherine, she genuinely believes that the best way forward and the way that people can make the most amount of good to the most amount of people, which elegantly follows on from Lucy's talk about how you can make a difference by making a difference where you can, when you can. Annie does believe that, but she also is grounded enough and connected enough with other people that she knows that she is doing something that some people will hate her for, because she is coming to them expressly wanting to take them from a place that they have lived in and managed to stay alive for this long, so it's likely that they're doing all right for themselves, and suddenly take them somewhere that is most likely going to get them killed within a year when they've been managing to survive for 9. And it's something which I think that none of that would be lost on her. She's able to see people and read people well enough that she can understand that way of thinking. And I don't know if she necessarily would disagree entirely with it. So she has to, I think, balance the greater good.
yeah, that's getting into a completely different story.
And in this case, it really does feel like it is for the greater good, that she knows that this is the right thing to do as a collective, but on an individual basis, this sucks. And she knows that this sucks. So she has to take that responsibility for all of its hardships.
As I listen to Toby and I carefully pick our way through these thoughts, I cannot help but reflect on the metatext of living in this new world, based on moments that he and I have already discussed in Let Them Go, and more still to come in later books. Rebecca struggled with this internal turmoil in the climactic moments of her story, and Annie makes a compelling case for why we need people to risk the dangers of the chaotic world to make it safer for all. The needs of the many, and all that.
Remember what Bilbo used to say? It's a dangerous business,
Frodo. Going out your door, you step onto the road, and if you don't keep your feet, there's no knowing where you might be swept off to.
When Frodo quotes this to Sam to help him pass this moment of anxiety, he is trying to reassure his friend that the uncertainty of the unknown can be exciting and gratifying. And he's not necessarily wrong in doing so. But we only hear the first part of that quote now. In 2020, the parallels between our world and New Century are stark, and I choose not to go too far into them, because you don't really need me to highlight them for you further. Today, staying inside is the safer thing to do, physically and emotionally. It is made more taxing because of the actions of those who do not heed the danger. And as I write these lines, I am reading a very recent account by Alex himself that puts this idea into relief. Our cartographer's handbook is the internet, telling many stories of survival, of loss, of the new normal, outlining what we need to do to carry on in this time of pandemic. But we do not have a Thomas Arlington looking out for the Annies and Franks, Jameses and Abigails of the world. And we cannot wait for such a hero to emerge. We have to find the Arlington in ourselves and protect each other as best we can. And for many of us, we are also Annie, unable to turn off our empathy during this time of strife, using it in the hopes that it can do some good, but also constantly at risk of being overwhelmed. We may be personally untouched by tragedy thus far, but we must never lose sight of the importance of that empathy in preventing further catastrophe. We are going to be talking a lot more about Annie's ongoing arc, because even above and beyond this particular story, she is going to continue to play a big role in New Century. So for now, let's move on from that.
Yeah.
Before we moved on, Toby added a point of interest in regards to Annie Oakley and Frank Butler that I will briefly cover here. While this story is not really about the two of them, and later books will get into their lives in far greater detail, their presence here at the beginning of our narrative is meant to be a signature component of the genre of alternate history. Alternate history is a subgenre of speculative fiction that stands alongside and sometimes crosses over with science fiction and fantasy fiction. In the case of New Century, there are obviously multiple crossovers with these various subgenres. Popular examples of alternate history include the Philip K. Dick novel, The Man in the High Castle, which was adapted into a well-received TV show on Amazon Prime, as well as the Fallout video game series, both of whom central premise is an alternate version of events post or during World War II. Annie and Frank are our historical touchstones. Based on people that actually existed, they ground us in a world where much is different, even if our understanding of them is based on other fictional biographical depictions, or even just a passing, "Oh yeah, I've heard of that person." Their presence, therefore, is not only to introduce James and Abigail to this brave new world, but the audience as well. It's a shorthand to let us know what we're in for, and was even more important back when Annie's voice was our first introduction to New Century, like Galadriel's voice in the prelude to the Fellowship of the Ring. But let's get back to our primary protagonists. James and Abigail are not your typical adventure duo. As opposed to Annie and Frank, who comfortably fit several aspects of the battle couple trope, our primary protagonists subvert expectations even in these early pages. Abby starts out as a lancer, a hot-headed foil to Annie's experienced hero, and James seems to sublimate himself to the role of support character, an observer of events rather than a man of action. Obviously, those who have already read Secret Rooms know these roles dramatically change in short order, but it also means there is no direct fictional counterpart for our protagonists, something that Toby and I generally agree is a strength of the novel. Which doesn't mean that there are no media influences to speak of. One of the things that you're going to notice, especially of James going forward, is that he tends to have a clipped way of speaking, particularly as he's taking in new information and trying to explain what he knows and what he's surmised from these details. There is a feel to it that is very Robert Downey Jr. playing Sherlock Holmes.
Exactly, the example I was thinking of.
In these four chapters, it specifically comes up where James is explaining the things that he gleaned off of the conversation with the other cartographers and how he surmised that there was an affair going on. It's going to become more pronounced in the following chapters as Frank takes James out in order to figure out, not crime scenes, so to speak, but, you know, just moments where there's no one around to give an account and they have to figure out the details of how things happen just from the placement of items or bodies or whatever else is going on there. To say that James is Sherlock Holmes is, I feel like, doing him a disservice, because his situation is a little bit more complicated than that. For one thing, James doesn't have nearly as powerful an ego as Sherlock Holmes does. I wouldn't necessarily say that Sherlock Holmes as an archetype, especially since there have been so many different interpretations of him, is an introvert per se, but it does feel like as much as he enjoys the company of others, but also can get lost in his own little world and may forget to connect with people, it feels like he genuinely likes people. I mean, maybe he didn't necessarily connect with the other cartographers, as, you know, is implied, where Frank is saying, "Hey, come and have breakfast with everybody. These are some great guys. It'll be a hoot.
You'll have a whale of a time getting to know them."
I didn't.
It's wonderful. I'll have to find that part of the book, because I can only imagine, like, just the layout of reading that paragraph, and just the simple line there has just as much kick to it as the vocal delivery. But anyway, carry on.
He does develop an ongoing rapport with Frank, at least. And unlike most depictions of Sherlock Holmes, he is at the very least not rude when interacting with people he doesn't know. And he still has a strong emotional connection to Abigail, although it's Abigail that is the one that first reveals the idea that there is something rotten in the state of Denmark, so to speak, in terms of their personal relationship. We don't get a sense of that at all from when James is the one speaking and narrating out his journal entries. He has nothing but good things to say about Abigail and no implication at all of any difficulty in their working relationship or their past personal relationship.
It's one of those things which emphasizes what you were discussing earlier about the added intrigue of, oh, what's happened to make things turn sour? Because the very last thing we saw in that first part was something that kind of strengthened Abigail and James's bond. It was them deciding to drink the bottle together, so much so that the last notes of chapter 5 are about how James can remember Lucy having a look of kind of a pained look that she wasn't also part of that and therefore didn't have that same bonding moment that strengthened their connection. And
oh, good. So we did cover chapter 5 a little bit after all.
Those give you a bit of whiplash that you go from, oh man, I can sense, like, you know, a fantastic journey ahead for these two as they tackle the world together. And then the next thing you hear is,
even if we aren't friends anymore.
You're like, whoa, like, if there was something that strengthened their bond like that, it does suggest that whatever has made them grow distant is also something that was relatively intense, or at least, you know, it had the strength behind it to counter whatever happened to kind of bond them in the first place.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit more for a second here, because again, this was something I was meaning to talk about earlier, and it got lost in the cracks a little bit. This was something I was even meaning to talk about in the previous episode, specifically that moment with Lucy and Potts, the doctor, the ending result of that particular encounter. So in Chapter 7, which is Abigail's first opportunity to speak on everything that has happened since we last saw her 9 years ago, one of the things she goes over is that she's going to miss all of these different people as she's heading off into this new adventure. She's feeling elated and guilty at the same time because she's finally going to be able to have conversations with new people and experience new things, but she's also going to miss all the people that she left behind. And she says, more than anyone, I'm going to miss Lucy. And at this point, in the original story, we wouldn't have known who Lucy was at all. In the definitive edition, we now know that Lucy was very significant to a young Abigail. They imprinted on each other during those first few days in Weirwood, and then they had the whole thing where there seemed to be a connection between all three of them. Meanwhile, Lucy isn't brought up at all by James in his journal entries, which naturally makes us question why not, especially given those final words of his from Chapter 5, wherein that moment clearly lingered with him long after the fact.
In my mind's eye, I can picture her golden hair, haloed by dust motes in the candlelight, her face half in shadow, her eyelashes cast down as she avoids my glance. Ashamed of the fear she felt. I want to go back now and tell her that that fear is our survival instinct.
It was something that I found particularly, I was trying to decipher the meaning of it, not from the perspective of why James said it. Instead, I was more trying to understand what Alex is trying to say by having this be the final note that he wanted to end part one on. James is correct. Fear is a natural reaction, and is not something to be ashamed of, especially when you are young and inexperienced. However, from here, we proceed 9 years down the road, and both Annie and Frank are talking about the importance of trying to work past fear and gain trust. Fear is the enemy of collaboration. Maybe Occam's razor applies here, and the simplest explanation is that both statements can be true, and to never lose sight of that. But I'm curious if you have any thoughts about that particular moment at the end of Chapter 5.
Well, I think that it accomplishes several things. First of all, it has this slightly ominous note to it, because the fact that James says that he would have wanted to go back and tell her this thing has a certain air of foreboding, in the sense that it implies that this is something he may no longer be able to do for whatever reason, which seals the sort of eventual fate that maybe Lucy is frightened of, which is that now Abigail and James are bonded, but she was almost left out, and so she can't share that everlasting bond. And the fact that he says that he would have wanted to tell her that is kind of a sense of a distance there that means that he can't tell her this, which it does give the scene that extra bit of consequence and weight to it, that there is something which did last and it wasn't fixed in the moment. And from the sounds of it, it can't be fixed even now. So that's one thing it accomplishes. But in the actual specifics of what he says or would have wanted to say with fear is our survival instinct, I think that it does connect with New Century in the way that as we go forward, it's about sort of fighting against fear and the things that mm-hmm. hold you back from just lying down and never being able to get back up again. Mm-hmm. What Lucy may have been experiencing wasn't necessarily a sort of admonishing of her fear and a resolve to not let it get the better of her next time. I think that what James had identified was a certain despairing over her, like having felt fear at all, and what New Century and is fighting against and what James wanted to help with is despair in the sense that it can get the best of you. And the idea that James is proposing here, it's not to say that fear is your survival instinct and therefore you should always steer into fear because that's what's going to keep you alive. Mm. It's more a sense of understanding what fear is so that you can better understand how to use it. James wasn't 100 miles away from where Lucy was because he only took the drink because he had, I forget if he had managed to deduce something for himself.
He had.
And was just admonishing Abigail for not having pieced things together.
He was.
He definitely had this sort of retroactive, like, what the hell were you thinking? Like, you just drank that thing without, like... Like I said, it establishes this sort of foreboding intrigue and mystery of where did the relationship go in the intervening years. And it also does kind of end on this note of fear isn't, it's something that can be unavoidable and it's part of our life, especially in this world, but it's something you've got to use in that constructive way without letting it be the thing that controls you.
I love listening to you talk.
Oh, that's so sweet, Greg. Thank you.
First of all, you just have a very calming and musical voice. I don't know. There's something in the way, just when you get into a proper cadence, there is something about it which it doesn't lull me to sleep precisely, but it can be easy to get lost in not necessarily what you're saying, but the way that you're saying it. But at the same time, as I'm listening to you puzzle through it, both from a logical perspective and from an emotional perspective, it helps me to piece things together for myself, that I manage to make tiny little connections and things you say along the way that slot things into place for me. When I was editing this together, I proceeded to asking Toby for his opinion by sharing my own in regards to what the book and Alex are trying to say about fear in general. The important thing to admit here is that that opinion came about only after listening to Toby talk about it, and I really was at a loss back when this conversation first happened. However, I will spare you the long, drawn-out version of rehashing all of those thoughts, and call our moment of shared admiration an excellent stopping point for this week's half-episode. No bloopers this week. I'm saving those for part two, in case after the edit it runs a little short like has happened before. I had originally thought to have the outro be Ain't It Fun by Paramore, due to Abigail's experience going from being a big fish at Weirwood to just being a foot soldier in the RSA, but the chorus of that song feels a little tone-deaf right now. So instead is a song that has similarly upbeat music and similarly melancholy lyrics, but also a message of hope. I first knew this particular song as sung by Simon and Garfunkel, and as much as I love Paul Simon, in this case, I've got to give it up for the superior version done by the Bangles. We'll see you next week, and in the meantime, this is Hazy Shade of Winter.
Time. was so hard to please. Look around, leaves are brown, and the sky is a hazy shade of winter. Hear the Salvation Army band. Down by the riverside is bound to be a better ride than what you've got planned. Carry your cup in your hand. Look around, leaves are brown.